Welcome. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. This summer, for the first time, the World Health Organization released an assessment that listed aspartame, a popular artificial sweetener found in thousands of products like diet sodas and sugar-free gum, as a possible cause of cancer. To combat negative attention from the news, the industry trade group American Beverage then began paying social media influencers to sway consumers to feel safe about this popular sugar substitute. We know more about what happened due to a recent analysis by the Washington Post and The Examination, which looked at 6,000 pieces of content produced by 68 prominent social media influencers who are identified as registered dietitians. The analysis found that in many cases, their relationships with the food industry were not made clear to their viewers. So how can consumers distinguish misinformation from fact when it comes to the food and beverage industry and artificial sweeteners, sugar, and processed foods? And how are food and beverage brands using social media platforms to reach millions of consumers, especially young people? To discuss today, we are joined by two guests. First, we have Sasha Chavkin, an investigative reporter specializing in the environment and public health. Sasha is a correspondent for The Examination, a brand new investigative newsroom covering public health. Welcome, Sasha.
Thank you, Ethan.
And we're also pleased to be joined by Dr. Caitlin Gilbert, a Well Plus Being data reporter at The Washington Post. Before joining The Post, Caitlin worked as a U.S.-based data journalist at the Financial Times, where she covered many topics, including the economy, politics, and abortion access across the country. So welcome to Your Call, Caitlin.
Thanks, Ethan.
So I also want to just thank you both for this very important investigation. And before we delve in it and what you uncovered with that analysis, I wanted to start with you, Sasha, and ask you about the launch of The Examination. It was started earlier this month as a newsroom that specializes in global public health reporting. And looking at the website, it seems like you cover an impressive and wide range of topics, including the global threats such as climate change, but also China's smoking crisis, and of course, what we're discussing today. So I just wanted to start by asking you, Sasha, what was the inspiration for The Examination?
Thanks, Ethan. So as you said, we're a brand new investigative newsroom, and what we dig into are preventable health threats and who and what are responsible for them. And, you know, what we're trying to do with our reporting is to empower people who are in harm's way from those threats, and also to inform the public discussion on health and ultimately make people safer and healthier. You know, I think one of the big reasons we were created was we feel like there's a big void in this space, that, you know, preventable causes of illness and death, things like diet-related disease and smoking, are some of the leading drivers of sickness and death worldwide. But a lot of news organizations can't even afford a single health reporter, let alone a team that can do real in-depth investigations to show who's causing harm. And so what our mission is to fill that void and really try to help people understand who is responsible for unnecessary threats to the public health.
And Sasha, it looks like The Examination seems to have been modeled after the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, where you collaborate with other news organizations. Can you talk a bit about that model and why it seems to be becoming more attractive for newsrooms?
Absolutely. So I used to be a reporter with ICIJ. Our director, Ben Hallman, was a senior editor at ICIJ. And what we saw there was that collaboration on global stories can really multiply the impact that these stories have, both because it can take a cross-border issue and bring the expertise of reporters in different countries to bear, and because you magnify the impact when the stories all come out at the same time and you see the same story that's affecting the United States is also affecting England and France and Brazil and various other countries. So what we really want to do is use that model and work with top news organizations around the world, like we just did with the Washington Post, to expose the kind of health threats that aren't getting the right kind of coverage right now.
Well, Sasha, that's a great transition to our subject for today's Your Call, which is about the investigation that you and the Washington Post, with Dr. Caitlin Gilbert here on the line as well, about how the large beverage industry trade groups are paying social media influencers potentially to mislead the public about basic health information related to certain foods. So let's talk a bit about it. And Sasha, just staying with you on this, how did you first learn about this coordinated industry-sponsored and financed campaign? How did this come across your desk?
Well, we were looking in depth at social media posts by nutrition influencers and particularly registered dietitians. You know, as you mentioned, we went through thousands of these posts. And what had really caught our attention was how many of them were selling stuff. And we're basically being paid by industry to sell products or to disseminate messages that really seem to be industry talking points in a number of cases. And as we were going through these thousands of social media posts, we noticed that a number of them had this particular hashtag, safety of aspartame, and that they were telling people in these very confident, definitive terms that they had absolutely nothing to fear from aspartame, that the World Health Organization had it wrong, that their warnings were clickbait. You know, there was some very dismissive language that was used, and that people should not be ceasing to consume these products. And that really caught our attention because the World Health Organization is an international authority on these matters. And here you had public health professionals who were going out and telling people to disregard them.
And Caitlin, how long has this sweetener been around? Can you talk a little bit about just the risks of this popular artificial sweetener? We're talking about aspartame and just how it works and some of the context here.
Yeah, so part of the kind of confusion at the time was, you know, there are multiple levels at which aspartame is being discussed. The WHO warnings that we were sort of focusing on here were about classifying it as a possible carcinogen, which was the kind of bulk of the media coverage at the time. But as Sasha just said, you know, these influencers, by and large, were sort of saying very adamantly that the product itself was totally safe. Though, you know, in talking to health experts for this story, we know that aspartame, when it's present, usually indicates that the food in question or drink in question is ultra processed. And there's a pretty significant body of literature that indicates that ultra processed foods are sort of associated with all kinds of poor health outcomes. So to sort of blanket statement saying that a chemical like aspartame, which has been studied for, you know, decades now, is totally safe, was a pretty strong claim to make. So yeah, I think part of the confusion comes from the different elements of, you know, will taking aspartame immediately cause cancer? Like, likely no, you know, you need a pretty high dose for that. But to say that it's completely safe when the research doesn't seem to support that entirely was the issue for our purposes.
Well, and Caitlin, I gather there is conflicting messaging on this, not just paid messaging. For example, the FDA issued a statement disagreeing with the World Health Organization's conclusion. So how do you recommend that people make sense of all this contradictory messaging out there that seems to be able to be exploited by the industry then?
100%. Yeah, I think there already was conflicting messaging from the WHO's end. There are a couple different committees there that were putting out statements about aspartame as a risk and a hazard sort of at the same time. So it was definitely extremely confusing in and of itself. And the industry sort of jumped in on that to kind of quell any possible concern in this really timed manner. But as a consumer looking at this information, I think the number one thing we want to let folks know with our reporting is, you know, sometimes these dietitians are not just sort of saying things from their own kind of research and opinion. They might also be saying something with the backing of of a company like American Beverage and the soda industry. So just to be really skeptical about the content that they're seeing and making sure it may be a paid ad, it might be a message that's actually sponsored, and not just kind of getting the opinion and assuming it's completely 100% not paid for.
And Caitlin, how much research has been done on the health impacts of aspartame?
It's been, oh man, it's been many, many decades. Sasha, you might also know like the beginning date for that, but there's been a ton of research. And you're right, like the FDA has said that aspartame is safe for consumers to consume. It's said that for a long time. But it's sort of this ongoing question about research into the whether or not it's a carcinogen. That's why the WHO put into this possible carcinogen property, because there is evidence that it could at certain doses. But yeah, it's tricky when a lot of the research is done, you know, maybe not in humans, maybe in animals, and kind of translating that from those types of studies. So it is definitely still kind of will be continued to be studied as a topic.
And Sasha, just to give you a crack at that question, do you want to share anything else about the research that's been done on it? But also, I'm curious why the World Health Organization decided to look into aspartame in the first place, if you know the answer.
Yeah, so one thing I would mention, you know, a lot of the controversy has been about this this finding that it's possibly carcinogenic, for which, you know, the jury is very much still out. But the WHO also had a finding this spring in which they recommended against using artificial sweeteners of any kind for weight loss, basically because they felt that they didn't work. And I think that, you know, public health experts who I consulted at this reporting said, you know, there is an ongoing question about cancer or other health risks, and whether at high levels of exposure, those could be carcinogenic. But they said that the evidence is quite strong that at a population level, aspartame and artificial sweeteners are not going to help you lose weight. You know, they may work for some individuals, but overall, they're not recommended for people who are trying to lose weight and trying to protect their health. And that was another statement that the soda industry wanted to push back on, because it's also one that is very threatening to their business model and bottom line.
Well, let's talk about how they push back. I can give one example of the hashtag safety of aspartame that began spreading on social media accounts of certain health professionals. Steph Grasso, a registered dietitian from Oakton, Virginia, used the hashtag and told her 2.2 million followers on TikTok that the World Health Organization warnings about artificial sweeteners were, quote, clickbait based on, quote, low quality science. It's just an example of this potential paid influencer campaign. Sasha, can you talk a bit about who these influencer dietitians are? Can you name some names? I'm curious just to hear some background from you about how this world of social media dietitians works.
Sure. So, you know, as you mentioned, Steph Grasso is one of the most popular dietitians in the country on social media, with more than 2 million followers on TikTok. We also wrote about several others who have large social media followings who were part of this campaign. I think one of the key problems that is raised by this is, you know, these are people who have big followings because they are credentialed health professionals. You know, they put dietitian or RD, which is the indication for a registered dietitian, on their social media profiles, in their biographies on social media. So people turn to them because they are expecting real expert health advice that is not tainted by bias, that is not tainted by commerce, that comes from someone with a medical background. And I think what we're seeing is that in a number of cases, these very popular dietitian influencers were in fact being funded by American Beverage, which is a leading soda industry and beverage industry trade association. And also that in a number of those cases, they weren't clearly disclosing who was paying them to post these messages. So they would put a tag on the message that said it was a paid partnership or that it was an ad, but they wouldn't say who was paying for the ad. So a lot of people, including commenters on their TikTok and Instagram feeds, would respond, who's paying for this message? You know, is this a message from the FDA, the WHO, the soda industry? You know, what's going on here? And that's really a problem because, again, as registered dietitians, these are people who consumers turn to for reliable advice on nutrition.
Well, if you're just joining us now, this is Ethan Elkind. I'm sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. We're discussing a joint investigation by the Washington Post and The Examination about how the food, beverage, and dietary supplement industries are paying dozens of registered influencer dietitians to help sell products and deliver industry-friendly messages on social media platforms. We're joined by Sasha Chavkin, investigative reporter specializing in the environment and public health for The Examination, and Dr. Caitlin Gilbert, a Well Plus Bing data reporter at The Washington Post. And we also want to hear from you. We'll open the phone lines now, and we'd love to hear your thoughts about this topic. How often do you turn to social media for dietary advice? Are you getting confusing messages about what is healthy and what you should avoid eating? We would love to hear from you. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to yourcall@kalw.org. Well, Dr. Caitlin Gilbert, wanted to ask you, as you reviewed some of these social media postings, what really jumped out at you about this campaign that the industry appeared to be funding?
Yeah, so when we kind of started digging into the American Beverage campaign, I think the thing that was most striking was how similar the messages were and how kind of shared the very intense kind of dismissal of the WHO warnings were. And I think the thing that struck us is when we reached out to American Beverage, how they specifically sort of said they wanted to reach out to these folks because they are such trusted individuals. And so this sort of opened a can of worms of understanding how the industry is really identifying folks that they already know will be trusted in spaces like social media, where there's just so much information and content being thrown at social media users. And so registered dietitians are already elevated in that space because of their training and credentials. And in part too, I think the relationship between someone who is an influencer and their followers is so strong. It's very different than I think what you would get out of traditional advertising, like a radio ad or a TV ad, to the point where, you know, people really feel disappointed when they find out that an influencer they follow is potentially paid. And so that was something we saw sort of over and over again on these individuals' social media feeds.
Well, and the videos can be pretty fun to watch. Some of them mix in upbeat music with animation. They have images, very colorful food. So it can be very appealing visually. And certainly if they're telling you it's okay to potentially indulge in foods that there's pretty good science and might be unhealthy, you can see why people would gravitate towards them. And Sasha, just to ask you on this question, are there important clues about how credible the information that they're relaying might be? I mean, especially for young people who spend a lot of their lives on these social media platforms, how can we sort of alert people about the credibility issues and, you know, alert them to when they need to start asking some questions? Are there things that they should be looking out for in these posts?
Absolutely. Yes. You know, there are rules that the government has for what influencers should be disclosing on social media. The Federal Trade Commission, which oversees advertising, says that you need to make clear who is paying you for a message. And they say that if you're putting out a video on social media, it should say in the video, in addition to the caption next to the video, that it's a sponsored post and who's sponsoring it. We found that almost none of the dietitians we looked at were actually saying audibly in their videos who was sponsoring them. But many would say in the captions next to their post, something like hashtag ad or a tag like paid partnership. So the first thing you want to look for is if you've just watched a video, check out the description of that video and the caption next to the video and see if there's a hashtag ad, hashtag sponsored, or paid partnership flag next to it. Because that's your first indication that what you're really getting is essentially a commercial. However, we found that in many cases, dietitians weren't even properly disclosing these ties in the captions either. And in that case, you know, first of all, it's a violation of the rules, which the Federal Trade Commission, you know, could take action to warn or even fine the company or the influencer who does that. But the fact is that that stuff is slipping through the cracks. It is out there on social media. So, you know, as a social media consumer, you also should just be aware if someone is making really bold claims, you know, telling you that something that you've heard a lot may be dangerous is totally okay. You know, they're not providing clear evidence as to what their research or evidentiary basis for making these claims are. You know, that's the kind of thing where you might want to think, you know, this might be a paid promotion.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phone lines now. We have Craig dialing in from Palo Alto. Craig, welcome to your call.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, good. Hey, I just wanted to say that the I know you've touched on this a little bit, but the regulatory agencies are totally polluted by industry. Now, that's true about the FDA. That's also true about the stock market. We are not being protected by the regulatory agencies, okay? So I just want, I mean, that is absolutely the case. So I just want to make that clear. I'm not talking specifics about aspartame or the thousands of chemicals that are out there combining with each other in ways we have no idea about. I'm not even talking about that. I'm just talking about the regulatory agencies are not serving us. They are captured by industry. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Craig. So it sounds like, Craig, you see this as part of a larger sort of regulatory capture where industry is captured. The agency is supposed to protect the public. And Caitlin, wondering how you would basically interpret what we're seeing with agencies like the Food and Drug Administration. Is this an example of industry capturing regulators that are supposed to be there to protect the public?
Well, you know, we didn't look exactly into the, you know, the FDA for this situation, but I mean, the industry, I think, has operated and it kind of advanced and adapted its marketing strategies to sort of meet the times. I think another level of this is the industry's relationship with the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, which we talk about in the story. There's a longstanding relationship there. So this is a group, sort of like a trade group that represents registered dietitians and nutritionists. And, you know, they're regular sponsors for the group. They are regularly there at their annual conference, kind of operating booths, giving talks, sponsoring continuing education webinars for dietitians. There's a very longstanding relationship there that, you know, many folks have reported on at this point. The Academy, I think, also will sort of say, like, this sort of needs to happen. We're talking about food. We're talking about drinks. Like, there needs to be some sort of relationship with the companies that make these things. So, you know, their argument is that this is something we can't avoid. But many dietitians would say that those relationships are potentially problematic for their profession, especially when they're trying to give out, you know, advice and work with clients. And then in this case, give advice on social media.
And Sasha, anything you'd want to add in response to Craig's comment and maybe building on what Caitlin just described?
Yeah, that in the case of the Federal Trade Commission, you know, which is the agency that oversees the online marketplace advertising more generally, the real takeaway for me was that this agency is outgunned. They just don't have the resources to police a marketplace that has increased exponentially in size over the last decade. And the FTC does take action to try to prevent deceptive advertising on social media. They do sweeps against deceptive practices. They find, for example, a diet tea company $1 million about 2 years ago. And a number of influencers who worked with that company, including Cardi B, got warning letters because this company made unsubstantiated health claims and failed to disclose its relationships with the influencers on social media. People we spoke to, including the former head of the FTC's Bureau of Consumer Protection, whose name is David Vladek, was that they simply don't have the resources to police this full online marketplace. So, you know, they basically have their finger in the dike trying to penalize some of the most egregious cases. But the flood of questionable conduct on social media is just too much for them to be able to comprehensively police in the system right now.
Well, we're talking about how the food, beverage, and dietary supplement industries are paying registered social media influencer dietitians to sell their products, joined by Sasha Chavkin of The Examination and Dr. Caitlin Gilbert of The Washington Post. We will have a lot more on this after this short break, so stay with us here on Your Calls One Planet series. Welcome back to Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We are podcasting our show. You can find out more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. And if you have a show idea for us, you can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org, or you can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And today we are discussing a joint investigation by the Washington Post and the Examination about how the food, beverage, and dietary supplement industries are paying social media influencers to help sell their products and deliver industry-friendly messages on social media platforms. These influencers were paid by the trade group American Beverage to make these videos and work essentially on behalf of the trade and lobbying group that represents companies like Coca-Cola and PepsiCo. We're joined by Sasha Chavkin, an investigative reporter for The Examination, and Dr. Caitlin Gilbert, the Well Plus Being data reporter at The Washington Post. And we want to hear from you. We'd like to know how you go about confirming the credibility of sources you might see on social media or otherwise when it comes to decisions around your health and evaluating various health information. Do you look at the credentials of the source to determine whether the author or the organization has the required expertise and training and independence to provide that information? We'd love to hear from you. You can join the conversation by calling us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And if you'd rather send your question to us by email, you can reach us at yourcall@kalw.org. So let's play some audio from one of these social media influencer dietitians. We have one called Milk and Honey, who posted about aspartame and why it is safe. So let's listen to that.
Okay, I feel like we need to have a chat about low and no calorie sweeteners, specifically about aspartame. Aspartame has been in the news recently, and it's only a matter of time before it's in the news again. Over the next few weeks, two World Health Organization entities are expected to release two separate and potentially conflicting reports on aspartame. And as a registered dietitian living with diabetes, I'm here to help clarify these reports for you. I pride myself on giving you accurate, science-backed information so you can make informed choices about what you eat and drink. Clearly, as a zero sugar sweetener option used in hundreds of different products currently on the market in the US, this is an incredibly relevant conversation for people with diabetes. The two main questions I get asked about aspartame are, is it safe and does it raise blood sugar levels? First question, is aspartame safe? Aspartame was approved for use by the FDA in 1981, and the FDA has since reaffirmed its safety five more times. It has been used in food and beverages for over 40 years, and the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics and the American Cancer Society both align with the extensive body of scientific research that supports the safety of low and no-calorie sweeteners, including aspartame. Question number two, does aspartame raise blood sugar levels? For people with diabetes, low and no-calorie sweeteners are just one of many tools in the toolbox for managing blood sugar levels. Decades of research have shown that they help satisfy the desire for sweetness without affecting a glycemic or insulin response. So for more information, check out safetyofaspartame.com. And as these reports come out, expect to hear a lot more on this topic as the summer goes on from me and many other dietitians and diabetes professionals.
So that was a social media post from a dietitian called Milk and Honey about aspartame. We're playing that as an example of the industry-funded campaign on social media to help potentially mislead the public about some of the basic science facts and research being done on substances like aspartame. Dr. Caitlin Gilbert from the Washington Post, curious, as you hear that, what jumps out at you? What's your reaction to that kind of a social media post?
Yeah, I think the thing that strikes me the most is just sort of how unnuanced the commentary is. It's very kind of definitive in saying, like, this is exactly how you should be interpreting it. There's no kind of room for disagreement to what I'm saying is sort of the general tone of that kind of post. And so followers can feel more assured when listening to that type of tone, which was a theme sort of across the board with these specific campaign videos, sort of saying, you know, you might get scared reading a headline, but don't worry, like, this is 100% safe, right? It's the sort of 100% confidence in the statements that I think is problematic, in part because the research is not conclusive for a lot of the things she said. And so that's problematic on one level, but then the other level being, at no point, as Sasha said before, is she saying audibly, let alone in the content of the description of the post, that this is a paid post by American Beverage, which sponsors the soda lobby, who of course has a very vested interest in products like Diet Coke being, you know, sold as per normal.
And you know, Sasha, anything else that jumps out at you about that post, building on what Dr. Gilbert just described?
So you played the audio. If you watched the video, you would see that clicking that you heard in the background at one point is actually ice. And it's because she was pouring herself a glass of soda and sipping from it as she delivered this message. And, you know, that's the kind of very ad-like endorsement that a number of these posts provided that really caught our attention and made us concerned about what a consumer would think if they see this kind of promotional messaging from someone who they're turning to for reliable medical advice.
And Sasha, how influential are these influencers? How much reach is there? How do we know if they're actually making a difference in terms of how people are going about approaching their diets?
So I can answer that question in one way in terms of numbers. We did an analysis, which Caitlin led, where we actually looked into all the influencers who were in our sample, and we added up their following, and we found that those who were posting paid promotions of all kinds reached more than 11 million people cumulatively. So, you know, there's a lot of people who follow these influencers. I think their influence goes beyond that because they're also credentialed health professionals. And so other people take cues from them. For example, one other phenomenon that I noticed was that you would see some of the people who are funded by American Beverage posting these videos, and then you would see other dietitians or even just other people on social media repeating their claims. you know, when saying that, okay, look, this credible health expert has said these things. And so their voices get magnified even beyond their direct following based on the credential and the expertise that they have.
And Caitlin, anything you wanted to say about the reach of these influencers and how effective they might be in spreading disinformation or encouraging people to come to the wrong conclusion about some of these foods?
Yeah, I think, you know, as Sasha mentioned, 11 million was sort of the static way we can sort of measure follower number, right? But that, even as we were analyzing these accounts, that number continued to grow, right? So this is a snapshot in time of when we were looking at these posts. But these accounts accrue followers at a really aggressive rate. And beyond that, because they are credentialed health professionals, their posts get circulated in these sort of little, you know, rabbit holes on social media. So if you're already sort of engaging in nutrition content, you're more likely to be served that content, even if you don't follow that person, right? So in terms of views of these videos, that's almost like impossible to totally know, but it's definitely reaching a much bigger number than just the follower count. And so that's part of the reason why even someone with a fairly small following, like say 20,000, 30,000 people, their posts can get super amplified on a platform like TikTok or Instagram. And so that's part of why we looked at these platforms. And it's also part of why companies are looking at these platforms, is because they know the reach is so powerful from even a smaller account, not even needing millions of followers to work.
And we heard from Craig earlier about how industry, according to Craig's view on this, has really captured a lot of these regulatory agencies. So I'm wondering, what are the consequences for these social media influencers who are not clear about who is paying them to promote certain products? Who is minding the store here? Are there regulations that they're running afoul of? What can be done? And Sasha, let me start with you, and then I'd love to hear from Caitlin on that as well.
Well, so far, the answer is almost nothing. There have been virtually no consequences for influencers based on their claims on social media. You know, some have gotten warning letters from the FTC, but almost all of the oversight and the crackdowns by the FTC have targeted the companies that have paid influencers to promote these messages. As I mentioned before, the FTC has acted in some cases to issue warnings or even penalize companies that cross the line as far as making inaccurate or unsubstantiated health claims or failing to disclose that their ads are ads. I mentioned there was this company called Teamy that produced what are called detox teas. They're like these weight loss teas. And this company ended up having to pay $1 million that it had to return to consumers based on its misconduct in its marketing. But again, you know, there are a handful of the most egregious cases that the FTC has the resources to act upon. And the vast majority of cases are simply out there on social media. And I think it's important for people who get information on TikTok and Instagram to understand that a lot of the time that information is still going to be reaching you, and you need to be exercising greater skepticism and greater caution in understanding that some of the material that's out there may be paid promotions, and it might not be fully clear who's behind that.
And Caitlin, do you want to talk a bit about this challenge potentially of the regulatory oversight of these social media influencers' postings?
Yeah, I think specifically, you know, when we spoke to the academy that represents these dietitians, you know, they say we have a code of ethics, and if we see instances of dietitians kind of breaking that code of ethics, we would take action. That has not happened yet. And they sort of have publicly said that they don't monitor folks' social media feeds. On another level, you know, these folks are licensed individuals. So there is also a licensing level of regulation at the state level, though there's absolutely, you know, no precedent for that ever happening, of someone losing a dietitian credential for what they post on social media, in part because it is so hard to monitor, but also I think, as we've seen with some of these dietitians, they often will say, you know, like I did some sort of disclosure, or I did a sufficient disclosure based on like my understanding of the rules. It's a very tricky thing to hard penalize someone for social media. For dietitians too, right? Like I should also say, the number of folks we looked at, it's a very, very small proportion of dietitians broadly. Not, you know, most dietitians I would say are not on social media by any means. But it's increasingly a large source of revenue for folks, in part because dietitian salaries on the median level, it's around $67,000 per year. So increasingly very attractive opportunity for dietitians to get into this space and work with companies and get these sponsored deals.
And Sasha Chavkin, you mentioned that the Federal Trade Commission just may lack the resources to really monitor this stuff. So what would it take to make sure that we actually have social media posters that are abiding by the policy on the books, whether that's regulatory or legislative? Do we need new legislation or new regulation, or is this just a matter of capacity for the Federal Trade Commission to be able to do a better job monitoring this misinformation when it's not properly disclosed what the source of that information is and who's paying whom to say what?
Well, I think the rules are pretty clear. You know, the FTC puts out guidelines where it spells out in pretty specific detail exactly what you're supposed to do as an influencer who puts promotions on social media. You know, you're supposed to say in your video, if it's an ad, you're supposed to do so both audibly and in the visual aspect of it. You know, there are quite specific rules which were actually updated just this year. So I think what really is the big constraint here is resources. I also think that, you know, the FTC itself often seems hesitant to bring cases, in part because of their lack of resources. You know, what experts told me is that the FTC has to be confident it can win in court if it's going to bring a case. Which means that, you know, there are probably a lot of ambiguous cases where the conduct is not so great, but maybe they don't have all the evidence they need to win in court, where the FTC might decide not to act. So I think that both the resources and the mindset of the FTC would have to change in order for it to act, not just by deterring the most egregious cases, but by really comprehensively try to clean up the content that is out there on social media, and that people are encountering on a day-to-day basis.
So this is Ethan Elkind sitting in for Rose Aguilar. You're listening to Your Calls One Planet series. We're talking about how the food, beverage, and dietary supplement industries are paying social media influencers and registered dietitians to help sell their products. Joined by Sasha Chavkin of The Examination and Dr. Caitlin Gilbert, Well Plus Being data reporter at The Washington Post. Would love to hear from you as well. If you have any thoughts about how social media has impacted your diet, how you examine and decide the credibility of social media posters when it comes to making decisions about what to eat, please call in, join the conversation. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at yourcall@kalw.org. Well, let's go play another clip now from TikTok. This is from Steph Grasso, who is promoting sugary cereals in this clip. Let's hear this.
What?
The 90s called. They want their cereal back.
What do you mean?
It's 2023. Who still eats cereal?
Wait, are you being serious? Have you ever looked at the nutrition label of cereal? Look at this long list of vitamins and minerals it has. It has at least a 20%, I'm sorry, a 100%. 100% daily value of these vitamins and minerals. This is like a multivitamin. Here, look.
Let me see. More like a sugar bomb. 9 grams of added sugar.
Well, I want the foods that I eat to actually taste good. Plus, how many grams of added sugar is in that yogurt?
9 grams, but it has 11 grams of protein, meaning I'm gonna stay full a lot longer than you. Cereal probably has 0 grams of protein.
Actually, this has 3 grams of protein. Plus, with a cup of milk, this has 8 grams of protein, so that's 11 grams of protein right there. But if that's not enough for you, you can always add flavorless protein powder into your milk. Not to mention, this was $6.50 and it's gonna last me through the whole week. How much was that yogurt?
$1.99. If cereal is like a multivitamin with fiber, why doesn't anybody talk about it?
Boots me. I think people stopped eating it during the carbs are bad era and we just completely forgot about it. Do you wanna buy it?
Yes, please.
So that was Steph Grasso from TikTok pushing a sugary cereal as a protein-enriched healthy meal. Sasha Chavkin, your reactions to that clip?
Yeah, I hadn't heard that one before, but I think it's a great example of a lot of what we saw in this investigation. You know, it's not just that she's clearly advertising this cereal, but she's doing so by leaning on her status as a dietitian, as a health professional with expertise in nutrition. You know, she's not just saying it tastes good, but that it will provide you with the protein you need, that the sugar's not so bad, that it provides all these vitamins and other nutrients. And again, you know, maybe that's true, but wouldn't you want your health experts to be coming to these conclusions in the absence of commercial incentives? And, you know, I think that's the question that a post like this raises. I should add that the dietitians we spoke to, the influencers we talked to, what they said is that they only endorse products that they would use themselves, that they do their research independently before agreeing to join a commercial campaign. You know, those are generally the explanations that they give for putting out posts like that. But again, I think it very much illustrates what we saw in that there are these very nutritionally, scientifically oriented messages that are basically paid ads.
And Dr. Caitlin Gilbert, your thoughts about that clip?
Yeah, I think I'm also, at one point, I think she mentioned sort of like, oh, it's back when, you know, no one ate carbs and carbs are so bad. That touches on actually something we saw a lot in a lot of these posts where language that sort of talked about diet culture as being really, really problematic, how we should not put any sort of labels around food, calling them good or bad or healthy or unhealthy. And this was just really rampant kind of like across the board with these influencers. So that's just another thing I wanted to highlight there as sort of becoming the norm of the discourse online. And of course, industry, I think, is seeing these conversations and is more than happy to jump on board and work with dietitians that are speaking in this way because it works kind of perfectly with the ability to push whatever the product the company is selling is.
Well, we have an email in from Lisa who writes that this label on foods really upsets her as she read it. She used a different expression there that basically the labels are all over products and various health food stores, and they're hard to discern what's healthy and what's not. And so Sasha, wanted to ask you, with Lisa's comment in mind, how do we address this challenge? Can we do a better job about labeling food so that even if you have social media influencers saying one thing, people can potentially get clear information from labels?
Well, certainly that's an area of ongoing debate. You know, what a lot of public health experts push for is more prominent labels. You know, there's discussion of, for example, front of the package labeling as something that would give consumers more immediate information about the health properties of a food. I think that as far as reading labels and, you know, literacy in reading labels, I think one thing to look at is to focus on the numbers themselves as opposed to claims that are highlighted essentially as ads on the box. So instead mm-hmm. of, you know, looking at the one point that's highlighted to say, you know, this gives you all of your daily allowance of vitamin C, instead to look through the label and, you know, see overall, well, how many calories does it have? You know, how much sugar, how much fat, how many vitamins, how much fiber, and to try to get a more balanced picture mm-hmm. of what a food contains.
Well, we're just about out of time. Dr. Gilbert, I wanted to ask you one last question, which is, first of all, any final guidance for consumers around how to look at labels? We just heard from Lisa. But secondly, just curious what you've heard back about your investigation with Sasha and what the feedback has been there.
Yeah, I would totally agree with what Sasha just said about there's so many claims that show up on food products these days. So actually looking at the hard numbers. But also, I mean, I think working, if you have a specific dietary condition, health condition, like working with your physician, maybe a dietitian that you work with directly to sort out, you know, what makes sense for you and what's healthy for you is a good course of action there.
That's a great note to end on. I appreciate it. I'm sorry we're out of time, but that's Sasha Chavkin, investigative reporter with The Examination, and Dr. Caitlin Gilbert with The Washington Post. Thank you both so much for joining us on this really important issue.
Thanks, Ethan. Yeah. It was great to be here.
Thanks, Ethan.
And to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, and you can email us with show ideas and feedback to yourcall@klw.org. Malihei Raz is on produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Ethan Elkind, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.